The conversation you're about to hear was recorded on October 26th in 2001.
Good afternoon, I'm Alan Chartok. Historians have noted that the Holocaust was the ultimate visitation of evil by humans against humans. Apologists have gone to great lengths to narrow both its scope and extent. As the years pass, it's understandable that many, unrelated to these awful events by blood or ethnicity, would tend to distance themselves from thinking about them. But today, we're honored to have a person with us who did not turn his back. His name is Jaap Penraat. Jaap Penraat risked his own life to save not one, not two, not 22, but 406 lives during a time when many people found it easier to turn their backs or to kill instead. If Jaap Penraat had saved a single life, he would be a hero. But what do you call someone who saves 406 lives? What makes a person decide to save another's life at great personal risk to himself? What is on the inside of that person? I'll be exploring those questions and more today. But first, welcome, Jaap.
Thank you very much, Alan.
February 20th, 1940, Amsterdam. The Nazis round up 425 Jewish men and send them to Mauthausen, concentration camp where most will die. This act of aggression prompted a young Dutch Gentile, Jaap Penraat, to develop a complicated but ingenious scheme with which to save the Jews of Holland from the Nazis. By the end of the war, Penraat, a draftsman, ended up saving over 400 Jews by forging their working papers. With these papers, the Jews could legally travel into France under the laws of the Third Reich. June 11, 1998, New York City, Jaap Penraat is awarded the Medal of the Righteous by Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Heroes and Martyrs Remembrance Authority. According to the Israeli Consul General, his name shall be forever engraved on the honor wall in the Garden of the Righteous at Yad Vashem, Jerusalem. Today, Jaap lives in the Catskills of New York, where one of his neighbors, Hudson Talbot, after hearing about his tale of heroism, decided to write a children's book about his story called Forging Freedom, A True Story of Heroism During the Holocaust. Jaap, let's start at the very beginning. Here's a rude question. How old are you now?
83.
You're 83 years old. So that would take us back 83 years ago to what year?
1918. So I was born in the last year of the First World War.
Yes.
Which didn't impress me then, but it was a lot of hardship for my parents, of course.
Yes, yes. What were your parents like?
Well, they lived a very long life. They became 93 and 94. They died now, not too long ago. And that is probably why I did what I did and what I didn't do, what I didn't do. They were social democrats, which is a term unknown here, but they were, here one would say they were liberal thinking people. Mm-hmm. And they brought me up that way. And that was not a bad idea, because when I was 15 in 1933, Hitler came to power. And a lot of people were fleeing Germany then to Holland. Yeah. And my parents were not really involved in committees to help the refugees, but they were involved in how do you call this, when people do things on their own, when they...
Independent thinkers.
Yeah, they help people without an organization behind them, among others. And that's a funny story, actually. I was asked to give my passport to someone who would then travel to Germany and give it to a Jew, probably. because they were the ones who were prosecuted the most, of course. And which I did, which was very simple, because you only went to the passport office a couple of weeks later. You say, I just lost mine, and they gave you a new one.
Right.
However, you couldn't do that too often, of course. Years and years after the war, and that's how I know it worked, I got a bill from a hospital in Rio de Janeiro. Would I kindly pay something like, I forget, $20,000 or so. So someone over there...
still was using your passport.
Name got sick.
Let me take you back to your boyhood for a moment, if I may. Do you remember what it was? Because, you know, we're on the trail of what it is that makes somebody do something that is this extraordinary and this dangerous. Do you remember any sort of object lessons or things that your parents said to you or did with you that come to your mind now that prepared you for later on, for what came during Hitler?
No, there was not a single incident. There were, of course, all these people who did come from Germany. I spoke to them and they spoke to me, and we were surrounded by these people. Now, I must say that I grew up in a kind of artistic environment, if you want to call it. We myself was studying to become an architect. And so a lot of people who were in the arts, painters, writers, intellectuals, if you want to use that word, who were fleeing Germany then, came into my surroundings. And by talking to them, they must have given me the idea that it's worthwhile to get involved in saving people's lives.
Now, why was it that they came into your circle? Was it that your parents had such a circle, that you had such a circle?
I had such a circle as a small kid, 15 or 16, in the art school. I was surrounded by likewise thinking people, but to categorize them, they were artists, yes. Mm-hmm. And by telling me what they knew about Germany, it was not unknown what happened in Germany then.
So what year are we talking about?
I'm talking about 1936, 1937. Mm-hmm. And it all came, of course, to a point where the Nazis started invading Czechoslovakia, Austria, Poland. So now it was war, and we really... it's not that from one day to another we had to do something, because the Germans were very, very nice the first 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. They said, we come as friends and we want you to cooperate, talking to the Dutch people.
Sure.
We wanted you to cooperate with us and then nothing will happen. That soon changed, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it started changing by little things, like you needed a permit to ride a bicycle. You were not allowed to have a radio. You needed a permit for the riding on a streetcar. You needed a lot of permits. Permits were given out by the Nazis as stenciled papers, because there was no time, or they didn't have the ability to print them. So these were all, we called it stenciled papers. Xerox had not invented.
It's mimeographed in a way.
Mimeographed.
Yes, yes.
They're sort of crummy looking, but that's good, because it's easy to fake a crummy paper.
Oh, man.
And they became real in the German eyes if they carried a stamp, a circle, with the name of the office who had issued the paper, and then the big eagle with the swastika in the middle. And that was my task, to not only stencil the fake papers, but put the stamps on. I had an old egg cup, which was the exact size of the circle, and the rest I did by hand.
Well, you're jumping ahead, because I want to, if you don't mind, I want to just set the stage here. This is remarkable, of course. But first of all, I want to know, did you know any Jews growing up?
Yes. Amsterdam was not unlike New York. First of all, as a kid, you don't know who's a Jew. At least I didn't.
Right.
Jews were only, they were almost formed by the Nazis because no one knew. Well, yes, we knew that the Jews had a market on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And you could, if the other markets were closed, you could go there. And as a kid, I was a Shabbos guy. We lived among Jews. And I was always asked on Friday night to put on the lights. I didn't understand why they couldn't do it. And they gave me always nice candy and fruits. So it was a good thing to be a Shabbos guy.
Yeah.
Now I'm told that's a term which is not very liked by the Jews. In the book we call it a Shabbos helper because that is what is needed. Therefore, my friends were either Jews or, as we later found out, half Jews or quarter Jews, which came into being, of course, when the Germans came with their prosecution of the Jews.
Sure. So now you're a draftsman. What is a draftsman?
A draftsman is a man who can use... I was an architect. My studies had finished in 1939.
Mm-hmm.
I never worked as an architect, and I'll tell you why. As soon as the Germans came, they formed a Kulturkammer, a culture chamber, a kind of a union to which all artists had to belong.
Mm-hmm.
Decent people, of course, didn't want to do that, but the result was that you couldn't do your profession because as an architect, you always need licenses and permits from the government, and you couldn't get them if you were not part of this culture chamber. I had to make a living. I started making small tiles, the things from plaster of Paris, what you could hang on the wall, and on it was a portrait of Paul Kruger, the South African president, who in, I think, 1903 must have said, "Alles zal recht kom," everything will be all right, which appealed to the population then because they too hoped that everything would come all right. I sold a lot of them, made money. But then one day the Germans came and they trashed everything because they said people shouldn't be in that kind of business. It's anti-German.
And what year was that?
In the beginning, 1940. Mm-hmm. Then I started, I still didn't know what else to do. So I started making religious statues. At least they left that alone. And so that's how during the war, I made a living like that.
Uh-huh. So now, how were the Dutch about the Jews? Could you characterize that?
Well, they are like everyone else at all times. There are people who are... Most of the people think it's safer not to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you let them alone, they leave you alone.
Sure. And
then there are, of course, the people who really are Nazis themselves, their mentality. And then there are people who try to do something about it. I am often asked, how did it start with you? What was the first thing you did?
Consider yourself asked.
I do not really know. There was not a one day where I said, well, now when I speak to small children, I always tell them, if you walk on a street and you see a building on fire, you can do three things, but you can walk, you can continue walking as if it doesn't happen. You can try to help them go in it, or you can call a policeman or a fireman, let others do it. But you don't have, at that point, you're not standing still and you don't have a question in your mind for, well, I have three options, which one shall I take? You do, right away, you do something mm-hmm. which you didn't know you were going to do it a second before. You do things, what drives you to do it, I don't know.
When people are asked, you see these stories in the paper all the time about a policeman who, at great risk to themselves, go into a house, and they say, you're a hero, and they always say, no, I'm not a hero, I just did it.
Yeah.
But they, of course, are a hero.
Yeah, well, that is the qualification which they give you to you later. But the thought that if I am not a bystander, if I do something, I might become a hero, that doesn't exist.
That doesn't enter it, no, of course not. No. Okay, so now you didn't know that you were going to do this. I mean, you were asked this by children and others, and this has always been your answer. But could you give us a feel, contextual feel, for how this did begin? How did it all begin with you?
You start by someone comes to you and says, listen, I need a bike. Can you give me a permit, a false permit, so I am allowed to ride my bike?
So is that how it started with you?
Yeah.
Somebody came to you and said, you're a draftsman, you can do this?
I didn't even know who it was, but no, actually, the real first thing was we all had, all food was rationed, of course. Oh. And every day or every week, every 2 days, whatever, you would get a certain amount of food on a certain ticket out of a whole sheet which you got every month. And invariably there was food which was desirable and food which was not so desirable, and I started changing the undesirables in desirables. In other words, a pound of potatoes was of less importance than a pound of sugar. So it was easy to make from number 680 683. I mean, that's how you start doing these things.
Yes, and who are you doing this for?
Friends.
Yeah.
And myself.
Sure. Did you have any sense of danger when you were starting?
No, the danger was not that great. Yeah, well, they would have arrested you, put you in prison. And the danger was not so much that they would give you 3 or 5 years. The danger of being in prison was that every night they emptied the prisons, transports were going to the camps. Uh-huh. Or they would take 20 of the prisoners, regardless what they were for, as hostages. Because if they had killed a German in the street, they would take 20, 30, 40, 50 people out of the prisons, shoot them right there and then, as a represalia, to teach us not to do that kind of thing.
So it started with this business of changing some of these permits. But then when did it get into the next stage?
The next stage is that when they started prosecuting Jews specifically, I had too many friends. And the first thing to be done was we all had identification papers. We all had identification cards. The Jews had one with a big black J on it. Mm. And the first thing was, can you get rid of that J for me? I couldn't. I tried everything, bleaching, and instead of a black J, it became a white J. So, and the result was that I came to the conclusion you have to make fake papers. Mm-hmm. You have to start from scratch, print fake identification papers. Now, I was very lucky. My father was a printer. He had a mm-hmm. print shop. Mm-hmm. So I was very close to material which printers use, printers' ink.
Well, let me just interject and ask whether Papa knew what you were up to.
Yes.
He did.
He knew, and he helped me greatly. Not only that, I was married at that time to a woman who was a half-Jewish, which was another stage. You had some... You bought time.
You mean before they started collecting the half-Jews as well as the full-Jews? Right?
Yeah. And her grandmother stayed with my parents. My parents lived in a small apartment, the printer and his wife. Mm-hmm. I was not at home anymore. I lived separate. They lived with my grandmother, like Europeans do when mm-hmm. people get old. You live with your oldest son or your oldest daughter. The idea of nursing homes didn't exist, let alone in times of evil. You know, my grandmother died, and my wife's grandmother took her place in my parents' home. Mm-hmm. And she lived there for 3.5 years.
And she was Jewish? Happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
So?
So, you know what your parents did. Your parents knew what you did, but you never talked about it. Uh-huh. Talk is, well, as the pamphlets would say,
loose lips, sinking ships.
And of course, it is not that you couldn't trust them, that it was dangerous for that part, but you don't want what you did, you don't want to hang on to...
You don't want to contaminate the others with it. Yeah.
Because it will never help them. It can only harm them.
Sure.
So now one thing went to another. Now the Jews are being concentrated in Amsterdam from all over Holland, 140,000 of them, which is a lot in a small town. They had encircled a part of the town with barbed wire, and Amsterdam, all the canals, they had closed the bridges, so that ghetto was easily made for them. And from there on, they were brought by train to Westerbork, which was the only concentration camp in Holland for Jews. And from there they went to Auschwitz, of course, every Tuesday or Wednesday night. It became imperative to hide Jews, and that with false papers, so they were not officially Jewish anymore, but they were put, well, you know, the Anne Frank story, how people were hiding. I didn't know. It's easier to hide people in the country. It's difficult in a city. I didn't know too many people who could do that. Could hide people. So I had to come up with an idea to do differently than hiding. And I got the idea of making, there was the Atlantic Wall was being built. That was a wall of steel and concrete all the way from Norway along the coast to Spain.
German defense wall. Yeah.
And someone told me that, well, there were 650,000 people working on that. And someone told me that there is, I forget who it was, that it might be advantageous to take, to be as an architect, I should know how, to bring laborers from one point of the Atlantic Wall to another. I knew a man, a colleague of mine, who had worked at one time, long before the war, with a German construction company in Düsseldorf. And he had letters, papers from that. He gave me one, so now I could duplicate the letterheads. And on it we made letters. Yeah, Penrad is by our company, how do you call it?
Employed or?
Employed. He has to be a transport leader to bring people from one point to another point, to bring people from Holland to France. That had to be a perfect German. My German was not that perfect. And on false papers, even the slightest mistake is, of course, disastrous. But then again, I knew a colleague again of mine who had married a German woman, and they were okay, and she made always the papers perfect. Perfect German.
But every time you did something like that, Jaap, it was very dangerous, right? Because if that woman decided to turn you in, you never would have known.
You never would have known, and that's the kind of risk you live with it all day.
Sure.
I mean,
were you scared?
Yes, yes. Yeah. But then again, when you, in my travels with the people, when you feel responsible for their lives, your own fear, it doesn't disappear, but it gets pushed in the background.
So now you've got these papers to transport people from one place.
No, I didn't have them yet.
Yes.
Because now we had that letter from that contracting firm saying that I was the leader. But the real papers... That was only a paper of which you asked the Germans to give me a permit.
I see. This is an application.
An application. Now I had to go, and there were only two, what they call Prüfstellers, offices where they checked on all papers. Mm-hmm. One was in Paris for the eastern, for the western part of Europe, and one was in Kiev for the eastern part. We had to get to Paris with that letter. There were no trains, but there were troop trains. So now we had to get to Paris on a troop train because we still had no official papers to travel.
Now, who was we at this point?
That is a friend of mine, Krien Takonis, a photographer. We worked very close because he always made the pictures as they were needed on various papers. He later became... a very well-known photographer for Time and Life.
Really?
Lived in Canada all his life and died about 6-7 years ago. Now, we knew there was a troop train going from Maastricht, a town in the south of Holland, to Lille, a town in northern France. We had to get there. We got there in the middle. The troop train was supposed to stop in Maastricht around midnight, but trains didn't run on time, of course, then. And there was curfew. So we had to be off the streets at 6 o'clock. Before 6, we went to Maastricht. We went into the station and we did hide in the men's rooms. And when it was about 12 o'clock, now you can imagine how there are no lights on. Europe is pitch dark. And now there comes a train, a lot of noise. You have to get in it, but the train is already filled to the top. But you still had to get in it, which we did. It worked.
You had no ticket?
No, there were no tickets. Troop trains, you're either
you
a soldier or a sailor or an officer, or you are...
How were you dressed?
Regular. There were enough Gestapo people and enough Sicherheitsdienst and police.
All of them in plain clothes.
In plain clothes. Right. So we did not attract any attention. By the way, they couldn't. No one could have checked upon us.
Because we were sardines.
Sardines. So that's how we got to Lille. From Lille, we went to Paris, and now there comes the day where we went to the Prüfsteller with the paper. And
had you ever been in Paris before?
Yes, I knew Paris, yes. I had worked as an architect on the Dutch pavilion on the World's Fair in 1936. Now we decided to go one by one because one is less risk than two. And no, not when we applied, but that comes later. We went in together, we saw all these lines and the counter, all officers and ordinary soldiers waiting for something, which we didn't know what. Finally, it was our turn, and we came to a woman these were German women in uniform, and she asked what we were doing there. And I showed her the letters. We need travel papers. And now we already decided to get there around 12 o'clock. Supposedly this is 2 years in the war, so supposedly they have now already getting accustomed to the French lunch hours. Around that time it might be easier for them to help us do
it. In other words, get rid of you fast because they want to eat lunch.
And if they decided to call that Dusseldorf contractor, maybe the guy is at lunch too. So, although calling wasn't that easy in Europe, and maybe they had ways of doing it, the Germans. The woman said, come back at 4 o'clock.
Okay, but now let me see if I get this right. If they had called Dusseldorf, if they had a way of doing that, then you would have been lost, right? Because the guy, there were phony papers.
Right there and then.
Right.
They wouldn't take you to court.
They would take you out and shot you. Yeah.
Now, one after one, we went back at 4 o'clock. I could never find that woman again who helped us in the morning.
So now you were trying to be separate because it was too dangerous to go together. And if one of you got caught, well, at least the other one was left. Okay.
Exactly. Now, I again wait in line. It's my turn now, and the woman goes to the counter in the back, came back with a long red paper, folded many times, a courier permit, a Courierschein. Now I got a real German paper, which made me a courier to bring slave labor from one point to another.
Now, when you got this, can you remember that moment? Was it a feeling of exaltation? Was it a feeling of relief?
Yeah, you get the feeling. You get a feeling when you do a job and it turns out well.
Yes.
You know, you get a
great
good
elation.
Feeling.
Yes.
Yeah. With that, she gave me a big stack of white papers, again mimeograph papers, and these were needed to be filled out with the so-called workmen, mm-hmm. with their names and their addresses, who their parents were, etc., etc. These papers we took back to Holland as quickly as possible.
Again, on a troop train?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. That they were the only trains running.
Sure. Filled with the Gestapo and the
all
rest.
The time. Yeah. And what was actually worse were the Dutch police working for the Germans.
Really?
I mean, they were.
How were they treated? Let me just do a little parenthesis. How were they treated after the war, these collaborators?
Well, they killed the top guys. The others one got off. Yeah. I'll give you an example. I was arrested at one time and let go, and now I'm years after the war. I had to come to court to tell the there are no juries in Europe
to tell
the judges what happened to me being arrested by those two people, Dutch police who were sitting there. Now, I have to tell you what happened when they arrested me, because I had in my pocket, my jacket was hanging on a nail on the wall, and when they arrested me, they said, put in your jacket, come with me.
When was this?
Yeah. 42. I was arrested in my place where I made the plaster statues.
The religious statues.
And now they... because one of the people whom we bought identification papers from, because that was actually before we printed them.
Right.
They must have stolen them out from people's jacket or women's clothing. And then that was easy to change. There were fingerprints on it and a picture. And one of the people whom I got now and then papers from the where he was arrested, and he pointed me out as being the guy whom he delivered it to. Now, those two Dutch policemen, they took me to the headquarters of police in Amsterdam. And it was a hot summer day. The streetcar were they were open, and on the front of the car there were there were not even doors. There were a low balustrade, which showed to the outside. As the tram was standing there, I was able again. It was very crowded. I was able to get my hands into my pocket. Where my wallet was, and I was able to throw it out of the car at the moment that the tram started moving again. And I thought that one of these guys saw it but didn't do anything about it. Now, 2 years after the war, when they were in the dock, I told the judges my story. I said, now this happened, it's what they did, and I think they saw it, but they let it go. One of these guys stood up and said, had we seen that, we would have done something about it.
Really?
I mean, that's the kind of mentality.
Wow.
That tells you about the intelligence of police, right?
Well, I got you off the track. Let's go back. It was my fault. I said it was a parenthesis. Let's go back to you've now got the papers. You've gone back on the train. What happens next?
Now we come in Amsterdam. And, of course, I started going to my friends, the son of my friends, whom I knew were Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I told them about this, and soon we had, and I forget whether it was 19 or 20 kids, that I forget. And we started changing, making the papers for them. We gave them non-Jewish names. And that is sort of difficult. It's probably hard for Americans to understand that if you go through life as a Benjamin Cohen, it is difficult if from one hour to the other you become Henk Grotehuis and not give yourself away, because that's a little trick the Germans always had. When they saw people, they would say, hey, Isaac. And
if you turned around, you were dead.
That never happened.
Because?
Luck.
You presented, I'm getting ahead of myself, but you presented these papers sooner or later to 406 people.
Yeah.
And not one of them who was caught gave you up?
We had a man in France, Henri, who was always waiting at the station in Lille, which sometimes was hours and hours and hours late.
Can I just stop you for a second? When you say we had a man, by this time, was this a conspiracy? Did you have a group that was doing this?
No, Kreen and I, just the two of us.
Yes, okay.
The two of us. And I didn't do all the transports. Sometimes he did one. Sometimes we never went together.
Now, when you say went together, meaning what? Did you take them by the hand? Or
no, but you had to. I mean, now you had 20 people. You were one of them.
Yes.
And I had indoctrinated you quite well. And you knew name, a new address. And now you were a construction worker.
And did you sit there and have sort of conversations with them? You when you say indoctrinated them?
Yeah.
Did you do it in groups or did you do it one at a time?
No, one at a clip.
Amazing.
Because that had to be done, of course.
Yeah.
Well, they were all in Amsterdam, in houses. These things are scary. Looking back, doing it is not so scary because you know that you do the right thing.
Do the right thing. Okay, so now tell us about how this actually worked.
Now you have 20 people, and because that was the amount we knew convoy, of group which were transported, and then we went to... We had to find out what train was leaving for Lille and when. And when that was all organized, we went to the central station.
How would you find out?
How do you find things out during a war? There were no papers, there was no radio, there was no television, just what people tell you.
Just the networking.
There is a term for that.
Rumors.
Yeah.
Yes.
And not all rumors are worthwhile.
Right, so it, sure,
it's very difficult. But there were enough trains running that if one wouldn't have worked, you would have taken another. Well, soldiers are always on the move.
Right. So you were an official transporter of these people.
Yes.
You would have to get on the train with them.
On the train with them. And that went as soon as we were checked, it always worked well, worked fine. One time, it already started in Amsterdam, where we board the train and we come, you know, the European trains, they have a long corridor and a compartment on each side. And where we were trying to be seated, there were German officers, and they didn't want us there. They didn't want to travel with rebel, with construction workers. I went to find the Zugstreifer, the leader of the train.
Uh-huh.
The Germans had leaders for everything,
yeah,
including the country. Now, I told him the story. I said, now we are on our way to Lille. We'll work on the Atlantic Wall. That's a very important thing for you Germans. And he agreed. He went with me. He threw the Germans out.
Really?
And now the Jews were being seated there. That must not have happened too often. And you get a good feeling from that kind of thing.
Was there such a thing as looking Jewish?
Yes, that was. Although the most, if people ask me what was the most dangerous thing, I have to tell you this story. Now, we are in the middle of the night in a town, Culemborg. You were in the train, you were often checked. Whenever the train stopped, police would come in if it were a station, and they would travel with the train to the next stop. And the most dangerous were, of course, the Dutch police, because they knew, they had more feeling of who was a Jew than the others. And now this is, again, in the middle of the night. It is very dark, and it is terrible weather. Snow, hail, very cold. And the Germans, the Dutch police, the Culemborg is such a small station that only certain wagons were in front of the platforms. The others were still out in the field, a long train. They had us disembark. They stayed in the train. And the trick was always down with your trousers to show who was circumcised. And it so happened that in Europe, actually, non-Jews are not circumcised. So that was, they found out that that was a clean giveaway. And as we were standing there in the terrible weather, someone must have shouted, "Let's go, let's go." And they told us to come in again. And they didn't ask to lower our trousers.
Is that close?
That close. That was the closest I've come to disaster.
Now, what about things like yarmulkes and, you know, longer hair and all that?
No, no.
That all had to be.
That had to be. And they had to look like construction workers.
So how many trips did you take?
After a while, I didn't know enough Jews. But then we met a man, Black Jaap. I was Blonde Jaap. Yeah. That was about all we knew of each other.
Yeah.
And he was able to find us. He had a function in a synagogue, and he was able to bring us all the time new people.
You were so dedicated to this that in fact you ran out of Jews to transport, to save.
Yeah, well, I didn't personally know hundreds of people. I know
I can understand,
dozens of people. But
I can understand somebody comes to you and say, yeah, please, at the risk of your own life, please save my life, and you do it. But I can't believe that this was now such a commitment on your part that you had to go out and find people to save.
Well, again, when you're in this kind of business, that's what you do.
So now you've gotten all of these people, and you don't remember how many trips you took.
Yes, I know exactly, because Black Jaap once told me, he said, you know, Jaap, this is the 20th time we are doing this. And we did one more after that, so that's why. And he was the one, by the way, all these kids.
Was he Jewish, Black Jaap?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All these kids were going via Spain to England, and they enlisted. They wanted to fight the Germans.
Yes, I was going to ask you how this worked. So where did you get them to, and how did they get out of the country?
We brought them to Lille.
Lille.
Now, and there they were. Mr. Henri was always standing there. He was part of the Maquis. I had another Dutch friend in Paris who had organized the French part. France was still in two parts.
Yes.
They could travel with our false papers. They could safely travel through France on the along the Atlantic Wall.
Right, because
there was
nobody knew where
workers.
They were working. Yeah. Now, you said the Maquis. What was the Maquis?
The French underground.
Ah, okay.
The French resistance, the résistance. Now, these trains, by the way, these trains were long trains. Behind the locomotive, there was a flat car with cannons on it.
Yes.
As well as in the back of the train.
Sure.
So ever so often the train would stop and shoot the British planes. And you, the fact that you were bodily safe was one thing, but it was scary.
So the crucial moment for you for all of this was getting that license to be a transporter. Because if you hadn't had that, it would have been impossible.
Couldn't do it.
Oh, boy. So have you met any of the people you helped save since that time?
Yeah. As I said, many were enlisted in the Allied forces, stationed in Germany. And after the war, they were the only ones who could travel. They had cars, and they used Amsterdam, Holland as a holiday ticket.
They come to see you?
Come to see me. Many did. When we got to this country, it became less and less, although in New York...
When did you come to the country?
1958. Mm-hmm. Although one man still came in New York to visit us. He was not someone whom we had brought. He was the son of someone we had brought.
Tell me about how Yad Vashem happened.
At one time, Black Jaap, who now was an officer in the Israeli army, must have gone to Yad Vashem and said, you should give this man a medal. They sent me a letter that it come to our attention that you're entitled to this and that. After they had researched everything, because they do that explicitly. Now I am getting that letter, and I didn't even answer it. Mm-hmm. Because my wife and I never talked about the war. But then again, years and years later, my youngest daughter, who now got kids herself, 6 and 7, she said, Father, you should write it down. I like to tell my kids what you did. I know you did things, I don't know what, but... So I wrote to Yad Vashem, am I still in the running? And I said, sure, and that's how they gave me all these things.
So you went? You went to Yad Vashem?
No, I'm invited next April to go there.
Really?
But no, I haven't been there yet.
406 people you saved.
That is now, funny, not 2 weeks ago, I got a call here in Catskill.
You live in Catskill, New York.
That's where I live now. From the an organization in New York, a Jewish organization, something to do with what they call us rescuers. Mm-hmm. And they said, we have a meeting in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in December, and we'd like to invite, if we can, one of the people whom you saved in Europe, tell us where we can find him, a kind of, and we'd like to bring you to the podium, you know, one of these, this is your life stories. And so I gave them whatever I know, and I don't know what will happen, whom they will be able to find.
Wow. You have a commitment to telling children about this, don't you?
Yes, that's what...
tell us about that.
Hudson and I do that continuously. Hudson Talbot is the writer of the book. People call us, are you willing to come to our school? Are you willing to come to our college? And then we tell kids what this is all about. And the message is, of course, that don't be a bystander if things like that happen. Try to do something.
Can the kids relate to it?
Yeah, because I tell them that when they sit in the bus tomorrow morning and you see kids ganging up to someone because he's of a different color or he is of or because he is gay or because he is whatever it is, do something about it. And then you really get the feeling that they are, unless they forget what I tell them, but...
Do you think that there's an analogy between these fellows who stood up on the plane on September 11th and tried to do something and what you're trying to teach these children?
Same kind of thinking is behind it. Same kind of... Why do you intuitively do things... I don't know. I think my parents conditioned me to help people. I mean, they didn't condition me, but I grew up in an environment where it's very natural to do.
I want to ask you one fast question because we're quickly running out of time, and that is, how did it end? At what point was it over?
Our 21st, 21 transport, which I did, was very... this was in April 1944, and this was, in June, the invasion of Normandy came. So all there were no trains anymore. We must have had one of the last trains ever to go to France, and everything was in ruins. There were no. Well, you must have seen pictures of Europe.
Yes. And what happened the day it was over?
When the war was over?
Yes.
The best way of bringing this into words is one line from a Dutch poem, which I often quote when I speak to kids. It says, "Come tonight and tell me about the war. Tell me 100 times, and 100 times I shall weep."
There was a wonderful book by our friend Edith Vellman, who talked about the day she walked out onto the street. And she was Jewish. She was living across the street from a Nazi facility. And they were forced to quarter a Nazi major. She walked out, and they were all proud and that they had done it. And her Gentile friend, her so-called aunt, said, "We've done it, we've done it." Mm. Did you feel that?
It has never harmed me in my thinking, in my behavior after the war, the fact that I did the right thing. It has not harmed me that I felt good all my life that I did it. Not good enough to talk about it, because we never talked about it.
Jaap Penrot. All I can say is thank you for being here. Thank you for showing us the way.